Welcome to the Persuasion Lab. And it's a real honor in today's episode because with me is a career naval officer, Greg, the boss, Wooldridge, who has distinction of being selected to lead the Navy's precision aerobatic team, the Blue Angels, a record 3 times. During his command and flight leadership of this exceptional team, Greg took the Blue Angels to Moscow. This is the first and only time the Blue Angels flew international shows with an unprecedented stop in Russia. The Blue Angels were at the brink of being dismantled when Greg was called to lead them one last time, ensuring the Blues would continue to soar. Foundational to the success of the Blue Angels was a culture born of extraordinary trust and profound gratitude. Greg's led a major naval jet base, culminating as a winner of the President's Installation of Excellence Award as the best base worldwide. A man of faith, political candidate, and influencer of the world's top leaders, it's my honor to have my friend Greg in the Persuasion Lab. Greg, how are you doing?
Hey, Martin. Doing well. Great to be here. Glad to be here. Thank you.
It's a real honor. And you have negotiated, influenced, and persuaded at a whole other level, maybe 5 humans on the planet have done. We think, attorneys can influence and persuade, or someone head of a surgical team where precision, everyone has to be choreographed. But to do what you've done for so many years, how do you do that? How do you lead a team of experts at the apex of mental and physical capability?
It's a challenge, of course, challenging. I think what helped me with the Blue Angels was the culture that was already established there, a culture of gratitude and a culture of trust. So I always make the comparison of the gratitude being the foundation, the concrete foundation of this culture where people were happy. You know, they're glad to be there. And it permeated the whole organization. But to hold that concrete foundation together, you needed something that you put in concrete, rebar, right? And I like to call trust the rebar mm-hmm. of the foundation of our culture there at the team. So with that trust and gratitude comes transparency. And the way we did business on the Blue Angels was different from the way I'd seen in the rest of the military. It was all about being accountable and being trusting enough to leave yourself vulnerable with your teammates. And that's how we got better. And that's how we kept that bond going, both at work and off work, you know, out of work, off the job. So it was a unique opportunity working with high ego people, right?
Right.
But we had a way of humbling each other, which was good, either by call signs or just by, you know, knocking them down a notch when things didn't go right, but in a friendly way. I think the key to that, leading that group, I like to reference Vince Lombardi when he said, you know, man, we're going to go out there today. We're going to seek perfection, but we'll never find it. But along the way, we're going to experience excellence. And that's what we were looking. We wanted to be, you know, a culture of excellence born out of the gratitude and trust that we shared day in and day out. Lots of handshakes, hugs, and glad to be here. But we respected each other, too. And when it came to the entire team, 150 of us or so, their respect was crucial. And when you deal with those that weren't flying, it was so important for them to understand that you respected what they did. And because they felt that respect, they shared it, then they felt ownership and outcomes. So when the team had a great day, they owned it. When we had a rough day, they owned it, but they knew we would get better. And they kept that underlying feeling of gratefulness, of being glad to be here. So that's kind of the uniqueness of the Blue Angels and the type of leadership that we had to, we got to experience, or I did, and then those around me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, amazing. Now I have a few questions. I mean, you have to be super confident at that level, or you just can't get in the cockpit. How is there a special order to give the hyper confident, very confident people at the top of their career getting together and cooperating together. Are there any issues that come up with that? Is there a mechanism, or does it all go back to gratitude, as you say, and respect?
Well, there's a lot that goes into it, Martin. One of the things that's crucial is the training. And we started out with basic Navy standards being about 6 to 10 feet apart in formation. And then we practiced a little bit in Pensacola at the end of the show season in November and December. And then the 1st of January, we always went to El Centro, California, where the weather is beautiful, beautiful weather. And we practiced there until about the middle of March. So we flew 10 weeks with twice a day routines for 6 days a week. So it was a building block approach. And by doing that also, everyone got to experience what I call the debrief, the glad to be here debrief. And that's how we got better. And in that debrief is when I would go in as the leader, as the boss. They called you the leader of the Blue Angels, called boss. That was their new call sign when they got there. So I was the boss, and I always, in the debrief, I would open the debrief, give general impressions, and then tell everybody what my mistakes were and promise that I would fix them. And that's what I have. I get a great deal of joy out of taking that secret sauce of success to the corporate world. I've got an event on Tuesday at Walmart in Bentonville. I had an event, up in Skanamia yesterday with a company called PHI. And then I had two other events, one in Atlanta and one in Springfield, Illinois, within the last week. So it's been really busy. But that secret sauce to success in elevating the performance of your enterprise is the way you debrief, where the boss goes in with total transparency, says what he or she did and how he or she could do better the next time, and made that promise, and then over to the next person. And we called it going around the room, because we'd had about 15 people that were directly involved in that debrief. Nobody else could be in there. So it was a safe area. And we all had that same interaction of being confident that what we said would not get us in trouble, and mm-hmm. that it was expected. And so I never had to point to somebody and say, hey, Bob, what the heck happened on that event, or, you know, on that maneuver today? No, everybody would come up and speak to their own errors and make corrections. And so we got to the right answers rather than, you know, somebody saying, well, this is the way I see it, or this is the way I would do it, you know, blah, blah, blah. No. Transparency, accountability, and taking responsibility. It was a beautiful thing. And it started at the top. It started with the leader. The leader had to be okay with that. And the fact that everybody felt good, because they weren't going to get fired. I mean, yeah, we had a few issues in my 3 times leading the team, but just 2 or 3. But you never had to call anybody out. You called yourself out, right? And how cool is that? No fear. Some people say, well, you drove fear out of the workplace. No, we dissolved fear. It didn't exist. And that's what was unique about that culture and about that way of doing business.
Yeah, I can think of very cultures where any mistake is absolutely not what you want a thing. Any personal weakness is not something you want to be a thing. Any self doubt. And the issue is that's part of self-awareness. A lot of professions, you are penalized for any show of weakness, and certainly in my profession in law, sometimes in medicine, but you see people who are at a different level, and they're, I don't know if authentic is the word, but they know, they're critically aware of who they are and self-aware. And there are some, you know, I get called in to help, you know, CEOs, executive directors on like negotiation, persuasion, influence things. And self-awareness is not always there. It seems like that's fundamental. It seems like if you're in a high-performing team, you have to be pretty self-aware.
Absolutely, because if you keep things hidden, it's going to have a real impact on those around you, you know, especially in a dynamic environment with six airplanes flying 3 feet apart and sometimes four of us in the diamond flying down to 12 inches apart, which at 400 knots and, you know, in a 22-ton jet is pretty extraordinary. So we have to have total trust on the job. And when we're off the job, when we're, you know, time off, we have to have continue to have trust in each other, and we have to build that and reinforce it. And the transparency is a big part of that.
Let's talk about this. Leading teams, there are some heads of organizations, they struggle with, and this is, you know, the West Coast, so they struggle with being over authentic and over vulnerable. And at some point, there's this tipping point where that can, you know, cast a little doubt. What's that gradient of, hey, I'm being truthful, here's this, but then there's, like, I guess oversharing is one thing. Can you, as a leader, overshare with some of that vulnerability?
Well, yes. Good point, Martin. I think, you know, you don't want to get to the point where you're making stuff up, you know, to try to make yourself look vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, be vulnerable, but be strong and be confident in the fact that whatever that vulnerability was, you're going to repair it. You're going to fix it. You know, like if somebody came into a debrief with flying with the Blue Angels and they said, well, I've been out of position for the last three times we've flown and I've flown that maneuver. I've been out of position. And I don't know how to fix it. That's when mentoring would come in. So mm-hmm. we would mentor that person with, you know, I've seen that before. This is what happened to me. And this is what I think you might want to try. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to be transparent to the point of you know, sharing a huge amount of making yourself feel guilty or over dramatizing something. It was objective transparency. It wasn't, you know, this dramatic, oh, you know, I felt so bad and I did so poorly. No, it's objective because you knew that others would understand your objectivity and you didn't have to plead for grace or forgiveness, right? You were just saying what happened and that you would fix it. And that's my contract from me to you, as we would, you know, kind of call it a verbal contract.
Yep, absolutely. Greg, that's critical because I think there's almost this emerging culture of here I am, accept me as I am, and that's just who I am. But your element, the thing that you're emphasizing, which is critical in a high-performing team, is, well, I'm going to make it better. Yeah, here's this thing I did, and I'm not going to self-identify with the wrong thing. I'm going to try to improve it. I think some people, and they are young people, they're experienced. We have a lot of people who went through COVID and all that isolation where they say, you know, they're authentic in that here I am, but well, yeah, but it's not fitting in or it's not useful to anyone. That's a you thing. You know, it's like, and I think there is this lack of, okay, here's what I am, but in order to help the team or help the organization, I'm going to have to do better on this. And this is not about identity. This is actually about performance, right? It's what I'm talking about. Sure. Whereas there's a blur, and I've talked to organizations where there's almost like a competition on this dynamic of being, you know, accept me as I am. Yeah, we accept everyone as we are, but there's a mission. So how do you transition that from, okay, we have all these people with all their stuff, but there's a mission here.
Yeah.
Focusing them, influencing them to really focus on that. How is that done at your level?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think if you change the word of, you know, what needs to be done, just use the word an expectation of how you're going to do what you do, right? And mm-hmm. and the expectation of the style that you do it, and then overlay that with good leadership, right? If somebody's just not getting it, first of all, we tried to pick good teammates.
Right.
We had the luxury of of picking our own, which was unusual. HR didn't send you somebody. The Pentagon didn't send me somebody, right?
Yeah.
We rounded up finalists to be on the team, and we had a chance to examine them. That wouldn't be the word we would use, but to interview them and interact with them and see how they, what kind of a person they were, right? So, and sometimes you don't have that luxury, but when you get someone that has a quirk or a different need, that's when leadership has to weigh in, right? Here's our expectations, and what can I do for you? And then a good leader will always listen. You know, that's the most valuable thing you can do in a leadership position is to listen and give feedback. Try to make that person the best they can be. You know, highlight the good attributes, but really work on those things that are soft that you can make better, and set examples and always strive for excellence. But leadership really comes into play in the example you spoke of, where somebody just says, "Well, this is me. This is what you got. You know, what you see is what you got." Well, okay, but we can do better, and let's talk about how that might happen. What do you, you know, what can I do for you? What can we do?
Yeah, I think this reminds me of that, the book, you know, Good to Great, right? You can basically do anything if you have the right people on the bus.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times I've seen that in action. It's how you get the right people. And if it you know, we all are humans. We all go through different organizational changes, individual changes, relationship changes, and they may distract us and we may have to leave a team. How do you have, you know, are there discussions like that? Because I deal with a lot of, you know, corporations where you have founders, and at some point something happens through life and it changes, and that team member has got to probably move on. How do you handle that subtlety with these high performing teams?
Yeah, well, sometimes you just got to admit that there's a challenge there that can't be met. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it's a performance challenge that just isn't quite up to the standards you would want, even after giving of time, training, tools, all the things you need to improve that person. I like to sometimes discuss, when I do my keynotes, discuss second chances. I was the recipient of many second chances. When I got those second chances, and when later in life I got to give second chances, it was crucial to lay out the expectations. So if there's in your example of a soft performer, if you will, were they given the expectations,
mm-hmm.
the training, and the tools? I've heard many cases of employers. I had a friend, he said, "Well, I just fired somebody today." I said, "Oh, wow, that must have been tough." He said, "Nah. They just weren't doing their job." I said, "Well, did you train them?" He said, "No, I just told them, go get this done, right?" I said, "Oh, wait." So, you know, there's a lot of ways to get to that, get the levers you need to up that person's performance if they're underperforming. But I think back to your point was, what happens when you just can't get there? Well, then you look at their strengths and maybe help them move to an area where they can be a better performer.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's within the company, or maybe they have to leave altogether and give them a good recommendation, unless what they have done is egregious and intentional in a bad way.
Right.
So yeah, it's tough.
Yeah. No, that's helpful, because my day job is an attorney, and you know, my phone doesn't ring when everything's going perfectly, right? If people can figure it out themselves, they do.
Yeah. They're not going to pay money if they can get it themselves, right? Yeah.
Anyway, so
it's not about paying money. That's what I mean. But
yeah. So let's talk about, you know, your speaking career. You're this keynote speaker to the biggest organizations on the planet. Is there a commonality into those types of organizations that you observe? I mean, you're called in by the C-suite to give these speeches, mentor these people. What's the commonality of the people at the absolute top of their game in these organizations?
Yeah. They're all seeking excellence, and how they get there, the people they have, how they create that teamwork and that loyalty. And then how do you do that? What leadership skills do you use to get there? And that can vary with the culture. So we look at the culture, what's going on. And then I talk about the Blue Angels, and we make that linkage through the comparison of what the Blues do to what you can do as a company. So, you know, it's mostly seeking ways to get better. I like to look at it as, you know, a company comes in and their current state, how they're performing and the metrics they use to get to that state. Now, obviously, most companies, every company wants, every team, every enterprise wants to improve. So we look at how do you improve that performance? And then I back down again to the Blue Angels framework, and we call it the Diamond Performance Framework, of coming in to the organization with a certain belief level in what you can do, and then seeing what these established Blue Angels are doing, and you go, oh my, how do I ever get to that point, right? And a lot of times you can come in with a competence that you are already there, and then you start to go to work at it, and you go, wow, this is way above my level of expertise or my knowledge. And that's when you have training programs to get people up on the step. And that's what we did in the Blues. We took good performers and made them outstanding performers, outstanding pilots, the best of the best. And it's a way you do that. So I translate how we did that into corporations through this elevating belief levels and then discussing what you're going to do with a fine-tooth comb, mitigating risk, having backups, all the things you're going to need to do as an organization, and executing, and in the execution of what you do on a day-in, day-out basis or a weekly basis, however often it is, at the foundation of that is trust. And once you've done something, then you come back and talk about it. And that's a huge thing, is debriefing, because most companies organizations I've been in, they don't want to invest the time to debrief. And a debrief has a negative connotation most of the time. You know, that was screwed up, we need to talk. You know, well, right. No, you're going to grow if you get together after each evolution and discuss it openly. And again, I'll use the word again, with transparency and trust. If you do that, you're going to elevate what happens the next time, because what we would say is you debrief, and then you have this spiraling up of performance back to your belief levels. So if you come in from the fleet thinking you're pretty good at flying 6 to 10 feet apart, and you couldn't fly 3 feet apart and maneuver and even maneuver at the same time while you're 3 feet apart, you've never seen that before. You have to elevate your beliefs, and you do that through this cycle, this framework, this Diamond Performance Framework that gets you back up to where, as a group, you evaluate the beliefs of the group. What can we do? And then when you get there, like we would get to mid-season and go from 3 feet apart down to 18 inches apart after saying, okay, things are going really well. We're strong at 3 feet. Let's go ahead and try 18 inches. You know, let's cut that in half, right? How do you get there? Well, it's through this evolution, this Kaizen, but it's better than Kaizen, to change your beliefs, elevate your beliefs.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in my career, you know, leading primarily legal teams, it's people will adapt their behavior to what they believe is possible and what's expected of them.
Right.
And is that kind of what you're talking about? Yeah. Beliefs?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, there's a principle in cognitive psychology that says nobody. And I, you know, when I'm talking to folks in the audience, say nobody, neither you out there nor I perform at our optimal, at our best. We perform at a belief level. So if we can elevate our beliefs, our performance will follow. We can elevate our team's beliefs, the team's performance. And if you can elevate a customer or a client's beliefs in you, everybody's going to do better. And I talk about trust too. And I'm giving you all the headlines from my keynote, but trust involves a lot of really important factors too. And I can go into that if you like.
Yeah, sure. Let's talk a little about, trust.
Yeah, I like to call it the four C's of trust. when you're developing a trust relationship in the business world, in the work world, in the competitive world, the first word I use is competence. So you need to have a sense that there's competence in who you're working with or the team you're working with. They need to feel that about you, that you're competent. And I always use the aviation phrase, ace of the base. No, you don't have to be the ace of the base. You just need to show competence, right? Mm-hmm. That starts building the trust. The next one is commitment. So when you're, you know, working with a client in a legal case, you are showing your full commitment to getting them the best outcome. They need to come back with you committed to making sure we get there through their, I guess, transparency, if you will, and sharing. So when there's that sense that you're both committed in an organization, you're going to continue to develop trust. And then the third C is character, right? The character is the integrity part, the truthfulness. Do you sense that you're being clearly and honestly dealt with? It, you know, if there's any sense that they're blowing smoke, if you will, you know, you lose that respect for the character. So you want to have character. And the fourth C, the last one that really matters, I think, the most, is consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You like to see consistency in the people you're dealing with. Now, I always have the caveat to that. That doesn't mean you make the same decision every time, but it means as things change, that decision-making relies on the same values. So there's always the values that are there in making that decision that create and keep trust. You know, like when I was flying as a lead, if I, you know, my cadence was another C word, but it's not so much in those four C's, but cadence, if I said I'm coming left, okay, and on the K and K, the guy on my right side would turn into me. He didn't have to see me turning. He knows on the K and K, okay, that I'm starting to turn. So we turn together. It looks like we're welded together, right?
Amazing.
That's cadence. That's cadence. That's consistency, right? So the four C's, the competence, the commitment, the character, and the consistency are crucial to having this high trust environment. And consistency can dissolve all the rest. If you become inconsistent, that's a game changer. It's a trust buster.
Yeah. The you know, a psychologist, you know, we have neuroscience and psychologists on the podcast, and you know, this variable reinforcement schedule is how you drive people crazy, literally. And Cialdini, who wrote the book Influence, talks about, you know, we want consistency in the people we deal with, and we want to be perceived as consistent. It's like a point of pride. So these organizations that I help on the negotiation side, not so much on the legal side, is how they use, like, there's, I think, leadership, and I may be oversimplifying it. There's like almost two buckets. There's, you know, kind of crisis leadership, right? And there's kind of go for the gold, optimization, seeking excellence. What, you know, what are the differences in those types of leadership? You as a warrior, you've probably seen it all. Are there things in, you know, this crisis versus go for the gold leadership that we should be cognizant of when we're leading teams?
Yeah, I think your first point, the is like reactive mm-hmm. leadership or crisis leadership, right? And one of the things I teach is, from a flying, leading the Blue Angels standpoint, is hold what you got, don't flinch. In other words, if you get an input, you know, production line 3 is down, what are we going to do? Oh, you know, crank up 4 and 5 and 6 and get it all going, blah, you know, whatever yeah. analogy you can make to whomever you're speaking with. Stop, take a look. Why is 3 down? You know, tell me what's going on there, right? Show calmness in crisis situations and hold what you got. Don't flinch. When I flew over, I get called out to fly over Disney World one time, twice actually, and two different leadership opportunities to lead the Blues. And the first time, the folks at Disney said, and we didn't do flyovers, but the White House asked us to do it. So that was pretty much from the Commander Chief. So we go down there, and the Disney says, okay, we want you overhead Cinderella's castle at 1,000 feet at 2 o'clock, right on, be right on the money. And they said, once you pass over, then the fireworks will go off. They'll go up to 800 feet. So immediately the hair goes up on the back of my neck, right? Oh, what can go wrong? Fireworks and airplanes. Okay. Like AAA or what? What's going to happen? You know, so Disney leaves our briefing there in Orlando. And I sit down and talk to the troops. I say, look, whatever happens, hold what you got. Don't flinch, because it happened. So we fly over, the fireworks come up through the formation. I go, okay. I kind of thought about this. I did a little risk mitigation, risk assessment ahead of time, right? What could possibly go wrong? And sure enough, right up to, if I had seen one pop and go, oh, flinch, move the stick real fast, we'd have had broken metal and broken airplanes. So, oh, what you got, don't flinch in a crisis situation there. And so people rely on you as a leader to exercise the same kind of leadership that you exercise when you're planning something, with vigor, with courage, with knowledge, and knowing that we can do this, with a belief level that what we're planning we can do. That kind of leadership, they expect that steadiness, steady at the wheel, right? In any situation. So if that's where you have that, again, you have that consistency that builds trust. So those, you know, and leadership, you have to really dig into leadership. Is it acquired, or is it innate, or whatever, right? So, right. And there's a lot of argument about that. Maybe there's a combination, but I think you learn a lot. If I may blab on.
Absolutely.
in my Navy career, up until I took over the Blue Angels, I'd seen a lot of leadership. And, you know, you look at somebody that's ahead of you or leading you, and you go, wow, I like that characteristic. That kind of blends with me, who I am. I always tell people that I loved bosses and commanding officers that could tell a joke, right? I can't tell a joke to save my life, you know, and make it funny. So I said, well, I like that in a leadership role. I can't do it, so I got to figure out something else, right? So, but you see different leaders, different people would lead you. People read about leaders, you know, and you go, well, that part I can take, you know, and you start filling your quiver with those arrows, those specific arrows of leadership that strike you, and together they amalgamate. Is that a word? Help me,
yeah.
Attorney.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They amalgamate into your own style, and then you get to test the success of that style. Yeah. And wait, make adjustments. You know, leadership is a living organism, right? It's not on a piece of paper where it says you got to do this, 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 because the dynamics of where you are and who and what you're leading are always going to be changing, but keep those consistent points of trust.
Great. No, that was super helpful. One thing, you know, you mentioned culture a lot, and yeah. For like, I see kind of two dominant cultures of organizations that, you know, they come to an inflection point and then they got to change stuff up in order to get to the next inflection point that may or may not involve new leadership, may involve a lot of things, new capital, whatever. But one inflection point is like small organizations, they really are consensus driven, but if you scale, you can't always scale consensus. So there has to be some type of hierarchy. Can you change a culture that finds itself consensus driven? They get to an inflection point that is no longer working. How do you get them to a cultural shift? I mean, any ideas?
That's a challenge. I mean, you know, I talked about the Blue Angels with the culture of gratitude and trust, and always seeking excellence, always seeking perfection to achieve excellence, right? But to go back to your point about the way that company has grown to where you can listen to everybody, but now it's too big. You can't listen to everybody. So right. The truck driver delivering the goods never gets to hear you again or talk to you or exchange. I think in that mode, you want to continue to be able to hear that truck driver. So that's when the gent or lady in charge of trucking knows, hey, I want to know what's going on where the boots hit the ground. I want to know. And not only that, but I'll be down. I'm going to come by and say hi, and I want to talk to some of these folks, right? So you get a firsthand without that intermediate there too, so that you get a unvarnished or a fear. You know, if you go down with the their boss and say, hey, what's going on? There's probably a little background of fear there, unless you've developed this culture of transparency and dissolve the fear. So the transition, yeah, you've got to pick good people, good leaders to fill in as you get to the growth point where you can't do it yourself like you did before. You're still going to get consensus-driven decisions, but they'll come hopefully with a change in size to keep up with that size, the faster pace of being able to make the decisions.
Yeah.
Or with the same expedience, not so much. It doesn't have to be faster, but it has to be as quick as before. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I think that feedback thing is important. So I have a friend. He's a turnaround guy. So he goes in these publicly traded companies and he kind of turns them around and hits certain metrics. And he goes from company to company throughout his career. And he, you know, in his first day, he's like, oh my God, the turnaround guy is going to start cutting. And that's not it at all. He tried to meets with every employee, which may be thousands of people. And he will say, you're hired to tell, I'm not hired to tell you what to do. You're here to tell me what to do. So you've got to communicate to me. And that communication thing is, that's one of his bags of tricks is, you know, I'm not the expert on everything. You're the expert. If you're not the expert in your job, we should probably have a conversation. If this isn't your dream job, probably should have a conversation. If you think I'm going to tell you what to do every day, we probably have to have a conversation. But his theme is we have to converse, you know, generally through a hierarchy if it's a huge organization. But that conversation, he starts that with his directs. And then they just push that down where you have this feedback. And I think you hit it on the nail and it dovetails exactly what he was saying. This organizational communication is how you can maybe scale that, you know, it may not be consensus, but you will hear a lot more than if it were just a strict top down where, you know, you really have no connection to the guy driving the truck in your example, or the gal driving the truck. So yeah, no, that's spot on. But yeah, I like this idea of expectation. It's really, you know, it's in that act, that example, but,
yeah, it goes beyond job description, you know, cause a job description does not measure the level of performance. It doesn't measure if you did the job poorly or it just tells you do the job, you deliver 25 cases of soda pop every 30 minutes on your route, right?
Right.
Well, there's a lot of ways to measure that, and how do you do it better? You know, but you build an expectation of, you know, that's the job says, the description says this, but this is what we're looking for, and let us try to get you to that performance level, and tell us what you need if we're not you know, not doing it right for you.
Right. That's absolutely golden. Greg, Captain, it's been an honor to have you in the Persuasion Lab. Are there any like three bullet points you think you'd like to leave our listeners today as far as, you know, leadership influencing that team, these high performing teams?
Well, let's start out with a one word bullet, and that is listen.
Mm-hmm.
Have your ear to the ground. Know what's going on. Don't live in an ivory tower. Be out there. Now we're going to go way beyond one word, but when I assumed my third leadership of the Blues, the wingman on the team said, we refuse to fly with that flight leader. Holy smokes. Back in the days, that would have been mutiny, right? In the old Navy.
Yeah.
You know, well, you're going to fly with me whether I kill you or not, because they were afraid with his performance, he might get him hurt or, you know, cause a problem. And so that's when they brought me back. I had all these great people there in the squadron when I came back, great talent, but bottomed out morale. You know, we look like crap. We're performing like crap. It had to do with leadership. So I went down and talked to each and every person in the squadron about how I was going to give them 150%. I look, and I'm just asking for you to give it your absolute best. And we're going to get the team back on its feet. We'll get back down on the road. And I really trust you guys and gals. So let's go for it. So, but you had to stop and listen. What are their concerns? What are their fears? So as a leader, listen. Secondly, develop the people around you. I always said, I want, you know, I talked to the folks that work kind of directly for me. Said, I want you to have my job someday. Mm. I want you to be doing what I'm doing. And oh, by the way, it's fun. You know, a lot of times a boss will look like he or she is just like, you know, heads hanging down all the time. Like, oh, this sucks. You know, no, man, come on. Leadership is a blast. You're the boss. You get held accountable for the outcomes when they're not so good. When they're good, everybody around you is the recipient of the wonderful blessings of that success, right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, I told them, I want you to have my job someday. And so what can I do to help you with that? And tell me what I need to do. So that's the second point. And the third point, I would say is, don't reject challenges outright as a leader. Look at them. Poke your nose at the edge of the envelope in an airplane. You know, go ahead and take a look. See if what you've been challenged to do, less people, less money, more territory, higher sales, whatever. See, you know, take a long look at those challenges and don't reject them outright if they're things that could actually make your organization better. So as a leader, be brave, be smart, and listen and work to get your people to take your job somehow. And I don't mean you'd get fired, but you know, to see the joy in leadership.
Yeah.
Those are a couple of things I'd throw at you.
No, that's golden. And that's more timely than ever because I deal with a lot of organizations who have, you know, well, there are a lot of baby boomers. They're getting out. What's your succession plan? We really don't have one. That is gold for organizational institutional survival. So, hey, great way to end it.
Pleasure. Let me add one more thing. And that's,
yeah.
I talked to a lot of, one of the big concerns with companies is retention.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But not only retention, but those men and women that are about to leave that are the most knowledgeable in the company about certain things, and they won't share it.
Mm.
You know, this is my baby. This is my technique.
Yeah.
This is me, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell these youngsters how to get the job done. No, man, that's poison. That's how you get those folks that are the senior folks to really share. And again, do what leadership does. You try to develop the people around you. Give them the tools, right? Give them what you've experienced. Share. So all those things, I had to throw that out there because retention is a big problem. A lot of times it's either from retirements or going to a better job. Now, if somebody thinks they're going to a better job, well, that is a big challenge. How you reverse that course, I don't know. I mean, we all want to achieve greater things. In the Navy, it was built in. Every 2 or 3 years, we went and did another, you know, went to another tour of duty. But you didn't lose seniority or anything like that. So kind of a different animal. All right. I'm digressing too much.
All right. Well, Captain Greg, the boss, Wooldridge, thank you so much for this. This has been really great. And, you have been really, this is going to be one of our, I guarantee you, top episodes in the Persuasion Lab.
Well, thanks, Martin. I enjoyed it. Glad to be here.